Manila Chan. You are tuned in to Modus Operandi, the show that explores the methods and patterns of U.S. foreign policy all around the world and the history that reverberates in our lives today. This week, backfired alliances. The U.S., with hundreds of military bases all around the world, regularly arms, trains, and teaches methods for coups and color revolutions, all in an effort to gain alliances with leadership in countries who will be favorable to the U.S. But sometimes, those friendships have fallouts. We'll take a look at the MO behind these so-called strategic alliances. Then, blowback for the ages. After the U.S. armed and trained the Mujahideen in Afghanistan in the 1980s, helping the rebels expel the country of the Soviets, the ragtag band of fighters later evolved into the Taliban, which then took their Sharia law ideology across the country, seizing ultimate control now twice following the U.S. Forever War. Has the U.S. learned any lessons from their experience in Afghanistan? All right, let's get into the MO. AFRICOM, that's the U.S. African Command, which oversees the U.S. mission in Africa, a part of the Pentagon's 53 African partnerships from the African Union. They oversee those relations and control 11 combatant command zones. But they're not actually in the African continent. AFRICOM is based in Stuttgart, Germany, a long ways away from those bases they monitor and oceans away from American shores. Currently, numerous African countries are seeing coups of democratically elected civilian governments by military leaders who have direct ties to the U.S. Meanwhile, closer to home, once called the School of the Americas, or SOA for short, but now rebranded as WISC, the Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation, operating out of Fort Benning in Georgia, most universities boast alumni who go on to reach the heights of their respective fields, you know, like Nobel Prize winners, scientists who discover treatments for severe illness, things of that nature. But this school churned out murderers, torture experts, and those who participate in human rights abuses. Its classrooms and grounds took in mostly Latin American military officers, the brightest and most ambitious, and shaped their worldview to a stark good versus evil and trained them in warfare tactics. Now, critics of this school call it America's terrorist training camp and part of the U.S. empire building. But how can this be when the U.S. proclaims its core values to being that of peace and democracy? One thing's certain, no matter what the name, SOA or WISC or some say WINSEC, its graduates leave a trail of blood and tears in their wake. Is AFRICOM's mission really all that different than SOA's? And to explain more on how the U.S. strategic alliances often turn into backfiring alliances with coups sweeping across Africa is Netfa Freeman. He's an organizer with the Pan-African Community Action, or PACA, and on the coordinating committee for the Black Alliance for Peace. Netfa, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon. Now, since 2020, the African Union has witnessed a wave of coups by U.S.-trained soldiers in the countries of Mali, in Chad, Sudan, Guinea, Burkina Faso. Some of these men were soldiers, part of now junta governments, officers trained by the United States. Now, because of their ties to the U.S., does the U.S. then bear culpability in the overthrow of these governments?
Yes, the U.S. bears culpability, not even to begin with. It even goes back further than these governments, and we don't have that kind of time. But we have to see and understand the U.S. is the top neo-colonizer on the continent of Africa. After the independence struggles, there was a number of coup d'etats that were orchestrated, and the U.S. actually participated in overthrowing democratically elected Patrice Lumumba, Kwame Nkrumah. And then after that, you would see destabilization of coups, a lot of coups taking place on the continent. continent, and it became the program of the day. But now what we see is with AFRICOM emerging in 2018, I'm sorry, 2008, that and as an effort to continue to continue U.S. dominance and hegemony as a top neo-colonizer, it also has created an emboldened military class that feel no reason to take orders or to be beholden to the unpopular leaders that are emerging, that are facilitating neocolonialism and actually usurping the people's riches, the wealth of the countries, for themselves. And so with them being unpopular and then the military actually being the ones that keep them in power, they feel no reason to be beholden to them. A lot of them are trained by not just AFRICOM, U.S. Africa Command, but also the French, mostly French Foreign Legion and AFRICOM are the top military presence in the continent of Africa, the top colonizers on Africa. And so we see that they are being trained by them also being responsible for the conditions, the prevalent conditions on the continent that put people in despair and make them aggravate, antagonize the people in terms of the leadership that they are responsible.
Yeah. Now, what is the stated purpose of AFRICOM's existence, and how does that compare to the realities on the ground as to, you know, the results of U.S. training of security forces across the African continent?
Well, the U.S. is famous for creating disingenuous platitudes that are just propaganda for its missions and places. And so the stated purpose of AFRICOM and all these military commands, the U.S. is the biggest militarizer around the world. And its stated goals is to fight, you know, terrorism and fight violent extremism and to bring stability to the African continent. The actual goals, and I guess you could say they're stated in some ways, but they're not the official, you know, like not what AFRICOM has on its website, is to ensure the free flow of natural resources from Africa to the global market. I mean, this, and paraphrasing here, was a quote from Vice Admiral Robert Mueller, former military deputy of the AFRICOM commander, Kip Ward. And so he admits this in a conference. So we have to understand that this is the real stated purpose, and the actual results are a general climate of instability, violence, and insecurity, the suffering of the masses, and dissatisfaction, making people's living conditions untenable.
Historically, Africa has really seen many foreign interventions. The northern region saw more conquests along the western coast, French colonialism, the south, the Dutch. These days, the U.S. isn't the only foreign presence in Africa. There is also a lot of Chinese infrastructure deals happening there right now. How is the African Union going to balance the push and the pull between the world's two top economic superpowers pulling at Africa from both ends?
Well, I think the African Union won't be able to do that. We have to understand that the African Union is basically is a hollow shell of the anti-colonialist project, the Organization of African Unity, that was decidedly anti-colonialist, and they would be standing against the dominance of the Western countries on the African continent, and it can't do that. And I think what we also have to make a distinction between the relationship of China in Africa, particularly China, but, you know, other forces, and the former colonizing powers. The former colonizing powers have nothing to bring but, like, what we're seeing, militarism and gangster tactics using the international financial institutions like the World Bank and the IMF and the WTA, World Trade Organization, to strong arm and keep Africa beholden under the thumb of neocolonialism. China, on the other hand, and people could argue that it's doing this for its own political reasons, but it really doesn't matter. The point is, it's not gangster tactics, and it gives the African countries and the African countries an alternative to neocolonialism and leverage to be equal, more equal players on the world stage. So the African Union, as long as it is trying to recognize any legitimacy, and the African Union really being comprised of the leadership of the various countries and dominated by what we refer to as the comprador classes, as long as it thinks that the Western powers have any legitimate role to play in the African continent, it will not be able to bring any balance and push between the two leaders. And I don't really think it really should be. I don't think that should be the mission, is to bring about. I think they should be, the leadership of Africa should be looking out for the interests of the African people. And if they do that, and if we can have leadership that emerges that way, then it can even better, it's better suited to leverage other interests like the interests of China. It can't do that for the West because they only have one interest, and it merges all the way back to the 1800s with the Berlin Conference, and they're not going to change that.
There's certainly a long history there. Last subject here is, I'd like to know how you compare AFRICOM's military training to that of the School of the Americas, now known as WISC or WINSEC. Do the two serve the same purpose, in your opinion?
There's a lot to compare there. The two ultimately, essentially, definitely serve the same purpose, but they're operating in two different distinct contexts within the African continent and then looking at the continent of the Americas. But the military commands of the United States, whether it be SOUTHCOM or AFRICOM or even, like you said, WISC, keep back and beat back and make sure there's no movement, no formidable movement that can chart the course of self-determination for the people to be able to access their own control and do what they will to access their own resources for the collective good of the people. That's the essential purpose. They're operating in different contexts because I think Latin America has a much more mature anti-imperialist movements going on the continent, as we heard of things like the Pink Tide, which is becoming even darker, and we should honor that. And they're also the internationalism, like for example Cuba and Venezuela exhibit an internationalism that we're hard pressed to find. So unfortunately, neocolonialism is firmly entrenched on the African continent, and it's demonstrated by the leadership. So the role of the two things are the same, but how they have to maintain it is different.
Yeah, very well put. Netfa Freeman, organizer with PACA and of the Black Alliance for Peace, appreciate your insight and taking time to talk to us today. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. This millennia's old proverb seems to be the guiding principle for U.S. foreign policy, as evidenced in 1980s Afghanistan. Coming up next, we'll take a look at how this ancient strategy came to wreak havoc on America's shores. Don't go anywhere. The MO will be right back.
Only 41% of U.S. adults have enough savings to cover a $1,000 emergency.
We have record numbers of Americans who are on the verge of having their cars repossessed.
More than 137 million Americans are facing financial hardship because of medical debt.
In America, we do have a welfare system in place to help people who are struggling financially, but it's a conditional system. You have to prove to the government that you truly need help.
The simplest way that I can explain a basic income is that it's like Social Security for the rest of us. A basic income would be a monthly payment that would go to everyone.
That's $1,000 a month, no strings attached. I can use it however I would like. That means, I don't know, I just won't go crazy.
The reason that I am a fan of guaranteed income, because it is this idea that everybody is deserving just by virtue of your being here.
The 2021 withdrawal from Afghanistan brought an unceremonious end to the so-called Forever War. 20 years, $955 billion, roughly 2,500 U.S. service members killed, tens of thousands more injured, and rough estimates of civilian casualties put the number at around 200,000. All this bloodshed to root out the Taliban, which the U.S. claimed was harboring al-Qaeda at the time, more specifically Osama bin Laden, the mastermind of the 9/11 attacks in New York City. But if you go back some 40 years during the Cold War era, the CIA sent tens of millions of dollars in aid and arms to the Mujahideen, better known today as the Taliban. So a Taliban spokesman once said, "The Americans have the clock, but we have the time." Truer words have never been spoken. After 20 arduous years in Afghanistan, America departed the country in a highly criticized exit, an exit many say lacked strategy. America was forced out of Afghanistan, not victorious, but not on their terms either, but their adversaries. The return to Taliban rule took 20 years, but they've returned, this time with more equipment than their Mujahideen forefathers, as American forces raced out of the country to beat the clock, leaving behind entire bases full of supplies and equipment. Apache helicopters, trucks, medical supplies, anything you might find on any U.S. military base in the world, all abandoned at Bagram Air Base. But the months leading up to this hasty withdrawal, the U.S. was already trying to make deals with local warlords, tribal leaders, with rebel groups in a failed attempt to garner support against the Taliban, who was gaining back territory across the country. Once again, arms and money flowed through back channels of Afghanistan, just as it did more than 40 years ago. So, if the enemy of my enemy is my friend strategy didn't work during the Cold War era, why does the U.S. continue to think this strategy might work in a different era? And that is where we find ourselves again today. And here we are, we find ourselves in the aftermath of the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan just 1 year later. For better or worse, the wounds left in the Middle Eastern country are still very raw. Our international reporter gives us some details of the current feel, the climate of Afghanistan right now at this moment.
20 years of U.S. occupation, 30,000 lives estimated to have been lost in Afghanistan, 11 million refugees, as if those numbers weren't enough. 1 year since the U.S. withdrawal from the country, Afghanistan is faced with the largest humanitarian crisis in the world. Millions of Afghans are starving as much of the West has turned its back on the country under Taliban rule. The chaotic U.S. withdrawal, now made iconic in the tragic photos of American military cargo planes leaving Bagram Air Base, left seven civilians attempting to flee, dead, and hundreds more hearts broken. Adding insult to injury, U.S. President Joe Biden's administration immediately froze the foreign assets of Afghanistan to the tune of around $7 billion U.S. dollars to prevent the Taliban accessing this money. A few months later, through an executive order, Biden unfroze those funds, but made decision as to what to do with the money. Half of that money has been allocated towards a 9/11 victims and family fund, and the other half will be put in a newly set up trust fund the Biden administration has established to, quote, for the benefit of the Afghan people. The U.S. has yet to recognize the Taliban as the legitimate government of Afghanistan, and they are not alone in the sentiment. Canada has not only rejected the recognition of Taliban rule, but still have the group listed as a terror organization. As such, Canadians, NGOs, and other civilian humanitarian groups are prevented from sending money to the country, or even doing their own work on the ground due to sanctions. The 20 years the U.S. spent in Afghanistan was aided by hundreds of thousands of locals who now face death by the return of Taliban leadership. Nearly a quarter million, 240,000 civilian Afghan workers and aides, to be exact, are still waiting SIVs, special immigrant visas, to be processed by U.S. Immigration Services. This promise by President Biden yet to be fulfilled.
We're also going to continue to make sure that we take on the Afghan nationals who work side by side with U.S. forces, including interpreters and translators, since we're no longer going to have military there after this. We're not going to need them, and they have no jobs. We're also going to be vital to our efforts, so they've been very vital, and so their families are not exposed to danger as well.
Hundreds of other Afghans who qualified for evacuation are now stuck in third-party transit countries like Greece. There are another 43,000 people who work alongside Americans awaiting H-Peace, humanitarian parole visas, still in Afghanistan. So far, as June of 2022, the U.S. State Department has only processed 270. So, in the wake of the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan, girls are increasingly being barred from attending school. Women are only allowed to work in certain fields. Activists such as flying a kite are illegal. Taliban extrajudicial killings are on the rise. Millions are facing starvation. 20 million are at least food insecure. Over 1 million children are already classified as starving. Food ration lines wrap around many blocks in downtown Kabul. The medical system is failing. There are not enough doctors, no access, and not enough supplies. This country of approximately 40 million is now effectively a failed state in the wake of the U.S. invasion. For the MO, I'm Roxana Solano.
And joining us to discuss all things Afghanistan is Saber Nasseri, head of the Afghan-American Relations Office. Saber is an Afghan native and was a cultural advisor and linguist with the U.S. Marine Corps and Army in the Helmand Province. Saber, thank you so much for joining us today. So, Afghanistan is known as the Empire Killer. How would you summarize why the country received such a designation?
Normally, since 42 years, we, as an Afghan and Afghanistani, we lie to Americans, we lie to different countries. Nobody can invade it because we cannot support other tribes. Taliban, they are not Mujahideen. The real Mujahideen, that who are Northern Resistance Lion, they are fighting, they are still fighting against Taliban, taking revenge of America. And Americans, they don't know, they don't understand that we have a team, Northern Lion, and we have another team we call Azara tribe. They are fighting against Taliban. 99% of Taliban, they are terrorists. They are supported by Pakistan and Pakistani government. They are controlling Afghanistan right now, and they are leading Afghanistan right now.
Now, Saber, I'm glad you brought up all the different the tribes, and like, for example, the Pashtun tribes and all these different factions all over Afghanistan. It doesn't appear that the average American certainly has any awareness that such tribes and the different goals exist. So how far back does America's involvement in your country go? And how do average Afghans view America's involvement that, you know, at some point began to look like colonization after so many years, so much interference in terms of installing various presidents friendly to the U.S.?
Yes, normally majority of people of Afghanistan, that they faced the problem and the economic problem, security problem also. I know we have a lot of suicide bombers in Afghanistan right now. I know there's a lot of killing, the Taliban, they're killing innocent people right now, but there is no social media allowed to broadcast everything in Afghanistan. If any social media broadcast, they will kill. But majority people of Afghanistan, they blamed on America, on Mr. Biden. Mr. Biden did a big mess for Afghanistan people and for the world. You know, the first day when the America left Afghanistan, American left Afghanistan, the Taliban support Russia. And the first day, the second day, Russia got decision to plan an attack on Ukraine. And now China, Pakistan, Taliban, and Russia, they're working together to get all Europe and all Asian country, especially Afghanistan. We had, as American, I'm an American U.S. citizen, we did a big mess for our country and for Middle Eastern country, especially Afghanistan.
Yeah, certainly. I have seen those images of Russian officials and Chinese officials meeting with Taliban leaders, which is very different than how the Joe Biden administration has dealt with the Afghan officials. Now, did U.S. officials ever truly believe there was any loyalty among any so-called allies that they made in the country? Or do you think the Afghans that they dealt with in brokering these very fragile deals, these tribal leaders, did those people view these relationships as more transactional in nature, not true loyalty?
Actually, Afghan people, they are very loyal. But the problem is Pakistan leadership, that they are more stronger than our relationship. So Afghanistan, as I mentioned, we have many tribes. We have the tribe that they are very loyal with America and Americans. And there is another tribe, Tribe B, which is supported by Taliban, and Taliban supporting it. And that tribe is supporting Taliban. Even the government of Afghanistan, former government of Afghanistan, Mr. Ashraf Ghani, he was not loyal. He handled everything, all their forces, army forces, equipment to the Taliban. I know the all equipment was belongs to the Americans, but he was leading, and he left Afghanistan with their advisors.
Thank you so much, Sabir Nasari, for explaining to us the real things that are happening on the ground in your home country, and for speaking with us and having the courage to tell us what's happening. Thank you.
Hopefully we will talk next time again.
All right, that's going to do it for this week's episode of Modus Operandi, the show that digs deep into foreign policy. I'm your host, Manila Chan. Thank you for tuning in. We'll see you again next week to figure out the MO.